Session number 9378, Reel 1.
Air Vice Marshal Bennett, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, where you were born, Air Vice Marshal?
I was born in Toowoomba, Queensland, T-O-O-W-O-M-B-A. I was born of a family of cattlemen, and I lived there in the early days of my life before moving to Brisbane, and then later on to Point Cook when I joined the Air Force.
Why did you decide to join the Australian Air Force?
Flying in those days was a new thing. My brother, who was the resident medical officer in Camarwheel, was a great friend of the early pioneers of Qantas, the Australian airline, and as such I had contact with them. And that, coupled with the natural attraction of a new activity, flying, was enough to make me want to go flying very early on.
Which year did you actually join?
I think I joined in 19... 1928.
What kind of planes did you specialise in?
Well, in those days I simply joined up as an ordinary entry, flying general duties branch. I went to Point Cook, and I understand I did reasonably well on the course, and therefore had something of a decent start in life, shall we put it. In that I was, I wasn't top of my course. Not that we didn't have any sword of honour or anything like that, anyway. But I came out top of the flying. And reasonable specialization in technical matters.
So you didn't specialize either in fighters or bombers or anything of that kind?
Not at that stage, although I, like all young men, I wanted to be a fighter boy to start with. And indeed, when I transferred to the Royal Air Force by arrangements which were made during the Depression, you see, there was the Great Depression on, and I was given the option of going to England or else. I went to England and I opted for fighters and started my ordinary squadron life in a fighter squadron flying Siskins. That's the Armstrong Whitworth Siskin, which was natural. It was the most appalling aeroplane ever built, but it was good training. And I stuck that for nearly a year whilst I was trying to get onto every course I could think about for extra training. And I had the good fortune to be selected for flying boats at the RAF base Calshot. This was at the time of the Snyder Trophy. You'll remember about that time. And so I went to Calshot as an ordinary pupil on the course, which was a 6-month course, I think. Yes, Calshot was a 6-month course, and that really was the first step forward, because everything else up till then had been very routine. But the opportunity of this course did two things. First of all, as a flying officer, and nothing senior to that, you had command of your own craft. You went off for, you know, a week at a time in command of a flying boat. It was good for a youngster to have this responsibility. But in addition to that, I rather specialised in navigation simply because of interest, and as such made a little bit of a name for myself, which gave me the opportunity to specialise. I did go off to... after that course, I went to Pembroke Dock, which was a brand new station, or shall we say the oldest station in the Air Force, which the Navy handed over to us, having had it closed for about 60 years or more, 80 years. We did a lot in the way of pioneering work with Pembroke Dock. Anyway, I was posted back to Calshot, amongst other things, to be a lecturer, navigation lecturer, because of my specialized knowledge. And I didn't like that at all, because I was keen on flying. So I'm pleased to say that I did a deal with my immediate boss, the station commander, who was Daddy Nichols, and he agreed to allow me to have a double posting. My posting to Calshot as a navigation lecturer was not cancelled, but he managed to prevail on Air Ministry to post me to Calshot as a flying boat instructor as well, without cancelling the first one. So in fact, the whole time I was at Calshot, I was filling two posts. And that in itself helps a great deal, because navigation lecturer alone might have been fine, but it would have meant that I would have finished up with very little practical flying experience. But by having the double posting, I was fairly unusual, put it that way. And so I was able to use the connections of Calshot to my benefit.
Did you at this time feel that war was approaching?
I'm sorry?
Did you feel at that time that war was approaching?
Yes, by about 1933 we were beginning to get on edge. Hitler wasn't actually active then, but shall we say the goings-on internationally were ominous. Actually, in 1934, I did the McRobertson race to Australia, and I did that partly to get to know the world, and it was very fortuitous, because it meant that in order to get on that race, I had to have something special, so I got my first-class navigator's license, which was only about six in the whole world, and I got that license, got on the race, and that took me out of the rut. But at that time, it was, to give you an idea, the whole world was talking about war, and the race itself was in the atmosphere of war. And then a year later, it was Hitler time. And so we were right in the middle of it. But basically, the spurs to do things were associated with particular events, and then you reacted. And I reacted quite strongly in the position I was in at Calshot to take advantage of all the qualifications I could get. I got a lot more flying time in than I would have got otherwise. I got this navigation lecturing time. I wrote a book on navigation, which incidentally ran to 8 editions. It was the bestseller in the world, not only in England. And this was all because I'd got into the position where Calshot and its activities just suited me. Very good.
When you say that things were done in reaction, you mean in reaction to international events?
Yes, and personal ambition. You see, you take ordinary thing like a wireless license, which led up to a knowledge of radar. I did that because I could see that we were going to need it, and therefore that I should be looking to my own P's and Q's and getting things right for myself, and I did. In fact, one thing I always like to mention is that I learnt from Durban University all about cathode ray tubes, which in those days were almost unheard of, and they were tiny little things about 3-inch diameter. And of course there was no radar and no television. This is the luckiness, the sheer luck of being born at the right time. Things were just coming in, new things. And although that may apply all through history, it certainly applied at that time.
So when the actual war was declared, it didn't take you by surprise, presumably?
No, it didn't. But one or two little events occurred before then, under the encouragement of a number of senior Air Force officers and the government, I left the Air Force to join Imperial Airways. They were developing. They wanted to go over to flying boats, and I was a flying boat pilot. They expected to go on the Atlantic within a few years, and I was a navigator. So it was a natural that I should want to go to them, and being encouraged by my Air Force masters, I went to Imperial Airways, where I was taken on as a captain of four-engined heavy flying boats, which was something in those days. That would be in 1935. And from that, I helped a lot on the change over to the Empire-type flying boats, which was the four-engine. We call it simply the Empire boat, which Imperial Airways had 29 off the drawing board without prior testing, which was an act of faith which paid off tremendously, and proves that good design can be just as right as people who rely on testing, which they do at the moment and break up in the air. That made me a civilian for the beginning of the war, and of course that affected things. For example, I was doing the Mayo Composite aircraft test flight to South Africa, direct from Dundee to Cape Town, at the time that Neville Chamberlain was arguing with Hitler in Munich, and I was indeed held up because of that. I'm pleased to say we did get the go-ahead, and Neville Chamberlain came back waving his umbrella and saying, "Peace in our time," all very melodramatic, and I went off to South Africa. That record still stands to this day, a world record. And then when war came, of course, there was awful anticlimax as far as I was concerned, because having left the service to become a civilian for very good purposes, it means that I was high and dry when hostilities started, and as usual hiatus, what shall we do with this fella? I had the rather odious business of doing all sorts of odd jobs. I first of all went and did so-called espionage work. It was wide open, but it was anti-submarine work in Southern Ireland, which was useful to the Navy, but from my point of view was rather anticlimax. Anyway, I did that for some time.
What did it actually involve, this anti-submarine?
It involved test flying in Southern Ireland, who were neutral, in order to try and detect where submarine bases were and what the Huns was doing, Hun submarines were doing. We had a little bit of success, very educational, of course, from the point of view of the stupidity of mankind. But
in what way?
Well, you know, the farcical business of the Southern Irish pretending to be pro-German and all the friends in the village being pro-British, all living in the same community. Things like that were rather silly and childish, and apart from the fact that I learnt a bit about Irish character, it wasn't really a very worthwhile job, and it was almost childish the way, I mean, I used to be required to meet in a pub in the West End of London or in some country inn or something or other, to meet somebody from naval intelligence, things of that sort, when in fact it was so wide open that nobody could be fooled by it anyway.
And how long did that job last?
several months, about three or four months. And then I did odd things like, I took the Duke of Kent to Lisbon International Fair, things of that sort. And then along came the war proper.
You mean with the invasion of France? With the invasion of France, you mean?
Yes. Germany moved and went straight through the Maginot Line, was the classic one. They overran France in a couple of days. I was sent to France to try and recover the Polish government and General Sikorsky, the head of government, 3 days after the fall of France. And that was quite exciting.
Can you tell me in detail what it involved?
Well, basically, it meant going flying. We had a flying boat here, you see, one of the Empire boats. I flew down to Biscarrosse, which is a lake just south of Bordeaux, and I there met General Sikorsky, his aide, who was a colonel in the Polish Air Force, and I also had a French colonel, and we waited there whilst this colonel and Sikorsky, who were only armed with sidearms, they went off in amongst the German tanks. They were driving in Polish uniform, which looked just like a German uniform, and they mixed freely. They found their colleagues, the cabinet members from the Polish government, brought them back to Biscarrosse, and early in the morning, in semi-daylight, I got off the water quickly and got back to Britain. And the only thing that fired at me directly was a British cruiser, which was typical of the war. But there was awful chaos. Everything was burning everywhere, and ships at sea were burning. It was absolutely chaotic. But we did save the Polish government, including Sikorsky.
What kind of impression did you get of Sikorsky?
A very solid, sensible man. Had he lived, I think he might have put a bit of backbone into Neville Chamberlain, where it was very necessary, and it might have affected the war. But he somehow or other, I don't know what the details were, there were all sorts of silly rumours, but he went on some trip down to Gibraltar, again by flying boat, but not with me, and had a flying accident and was killed, which was very sad.
But when you rescued him, did he seem tired and worn?
No, he was solid as could be. He was a fairly short but very robust type of man physically, and I got the impression that he was very determined. You see, we went into this Biscarrosse base where the tanks were all around us, and on the roads, that is, and he didn't turn a hair. He confiscated civilian cars and went off looking for his people without turning a hair. He was a man of character.
Why did the German tanks not open fire on you?
Well, they had too many other things to fire. In any case, advancing tanks don't stop to fight. They always go to get there. That's a characteristic of modern warfare, of warfare of that time, was that you got on with it. You didn't... if you were told to go to a certain place, you didn't fight for every village, you just drove through it. Tactical use of tanks probably was more misunderstood before the war than ever, but it was understood by the end.
So was it not a scaring business for you?
Sorry?
So was it not a frightening business for you?
Frightening?
Yes.
Well, naturally, warfare is. But that is, you accept as part of the inevitable. But of course, it's nothing. The flying side is 1,000 times worse, so the ground side is relatively little.
So, approximately, how long would you have been at Biscarrosse?
I was only there for 2 days. No, 3 days altogether. 2 days really on the job, and got off early the next morning. But it was indicative of the chaos that existed that we weren't picked up. Just sheer luck. Because of the chaos.
Did you get into any conversations with any of the French people there?
Yes. The French had a float plane base there, seaplane base. And they consisted of two categories. They also had a Met office, who, of course, they all speak English properly, to save my French. I would say, in general, the division of opinion was half and half. The French were terribly pro-British or defeatist. There were a lot of rats who wanted to just get out and go. We should never have been dragged into this war. The British dragged us in. You'll recall we had a joint declaration of war. Anyway, they were of that ilk, but there were some very good Frenchmen there. The majority of them wanted to get out and come over to our side. And then, of course, we had the unhappy sight of the French Navy being handed over to the Germans, because the senior French people were rats.
Did any of the French try to get a lift with you back to England?
No. This colonel that we had with us wouldn't come back with us because he's trying to find his wife. And we couldn't contemplate taking anybody back with us because we had no space. We were full.
What happened after your rescue of Sikorsky?
I came back to England via Poole Harbour, and let me see, what was the next thing I was in? Oh, almost straight away, Beaverbrook sent for me and said he would like... first of all, he did some questioning. Would it be possible to fly the North Atlantic? And I said, yes. Would it be possible in winter? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I'm making up a little team of Imperial Airways pilots who believe we can do it. The Air Ministry, it's under Sinclair, a different ministry, are absolutely adamant that it's completely impossible. It would be suicide in winter time to try and fly the North Atlantic. And Beaverbrook was very, very anti the Air Force because of it. They were in uniform. You see, I was a civilian, theoretically. And anyway, he appointed myself and Will Coxon, who'd been Imperial Airways pilot, Humphrey Page, and Ian Ross, a total of four of us. And we went out to Montreal on a ship, where we were greeted by Beaverbrook's representative in Montreal, who simply said, anything you want, you can have. You must get all the aircraft you can flown over to England. None had flown at that stage. So I had to rush around, test new American aircraft that were offered to us, and advertise for crews. We employed civilian Americans to start with. And I said, this is not good enough. The quality is absolutely beyond contempt. We must have better quality. And we got 8 Imperial Airways pilots over from London, by sea, by the way. There was no other way of getting them. And we tested the Lockheed Hudson and Catalinas, and then later on Liberators. Everybody was very helpful, and the spirit was so right. I mean, things like, you take the Hudson, it's the range was proved to be just inadequate, just couldn't do it. So I insisted upon an extra tank. At the end of a 12-hour flight, I landed and I said, I want an extra tank. I'd forgotten how many gallons extra I wanted, but whatever it was. Do you know that they had a tank installed within 2 hours of my landing on the ground? And I tested it straight away. We gave them the right example by getting on with it, and they responded wonderfully. I mean, when I arrived, they said, when would you like to do this test flight? This was one evening. And I said, straight away. He said, what do you mean straight away? We can have it ready within a week or two. I said, not on your life. You'll have it ready tomorrow morning at 6. And they did. That was the sort of spirit. And so we got along quite famously. And within a matter of weeks, myself and Humphrey Page delivered two Hudsons from Burbank, California, up to the Canadian border, where we towed the aircraft across the frontier but with horses, because we were not allowed to fly them over, neutrality and all that. And we towed them over to a place called Pembina in near Winnipeg. And from there we flew along to Montreal, where we landed at St. Hubert, which was to be our base. And we got on with things. We had a certain amount of political pushing and shoving, but basically it was Colonel Burchill from Imperial Airways, anxious to do the right thing and give us all the help we needed, but he was non-technical, non-operational, so Wilcoxon took on the job of training controller, and I was operational controller. I was called flying superintendent, he was training superintendent, and we all of us came under the Royal Bank of Montreal's boss, who was representing Beaverbrook, and he in fact was the man to whom we were responsible. And they were terribly helpful. They did everything they could in the way of facilities and money and cars and so on. And the training and selection of these civilian crews who came as a result of our advertising worked extremely well. And when you remember, we only started at the time of Dunkirk. When Dunkirk was at its peak, we were jumping on a ship to go to Canada. And yet we did the first delivery flight of seven Hudsons on Armistice Day, 1940. They all arrived safely at Aldergrove, to the surprise of everybody, where we were received by the Air Force with open arms as an example of what was going to come, you see, help from America. Psychologically, it was important. Roddy Carr was AOC Northern Ireland at that time. He was Air Vice Marshal, Sir Roderick. Well, he was Roderick Carr then. And that was interesting because later on in my Air Force activities, he commanded 4 Group in Bomber Command and was a great help and supporter.